Sick Boy Podcast is a health and comedy show about what it's like to be sick. Wait, is that right? How can illness be funny?
You'd be surprised.
Okay. Sick Boy is hosted by
me, Brian Stever.
And me, Taylor McGilvery.
And myself, Jeremy Saunders.
Come on in and join us to melt your heart, learn something fascinating, and bust a belly laugh. Trust us, you'll be glad you did.
You can find Sick Boy on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your pods.
This is a CBC podcast.
There's this 13-year-old boy, Hernando. He says goodbye, adios, to his parents in South America and boards a sailing ship for Europe along with his older brother. It's 1549. Hernando is excited and scared. He's on his way to get a formal education in Spain, the distant homeland he's heard so much about. But the ship wrecks on the shores of Florida. Hernando survives and spends the next 17 years living among the indigenous Calusa people. He'd go on to say that he'd been held captive. During his time with the Calusa, Hernando Descalente Fontaneda also heard of a mysterious river that, according to legend, would make old people young again. He says the indigenous people of Cuba would make the dangerous crossing to Florida to search for it. And the people of Florida became consumed with this river too. He wrote,
"So earnestly did they engage in the pursuit that there remained not a river, not a brook in all Florida, not even lakes and ponds in which they did not bathe. And to this day, they persist in seeking that water."
Hernando had heard rumors that decades earlier, Spanish colonizer Ponce de Leon had traveled up and down Florida searching for the youth restoring waters. The river that Hernando described would soon become known as the Fountain of Youth, the most enduring symbol of the human quest to escape old age. And Ponce de Leon? Well, he'd become the symbol of that quest's futility. But while it makes for a great story, it's probably not true. While he did travel to Florida, and even came up with the name Florida, historians doubt Ponce de Leon spent any time searching for the river. He never mentions it in any of his writings, and there were no contemporary accounts of him doing so. Hernando himself was a skeptic about Ponce de Leon's search, and about the Fountain of Youth itself.
"While I was a captive there, I bathed in many streams, but to my misfortune, I never came upon the river."
I'm Keith MacArthur, and this is Unlocking the Fountain, a podcast about the mysteries of aging and efforts to slow, stop, or even reverse it. A growing number of scientists and doctors say this may soon be possible. And I want to believe. But this new science follows centuries of made-up legends, bad medicine, and outright hucksters falsely promising eternal youth.
"I've got the answer right here, ladies and gentlemen, to everything that ails you. Now step right up."
"Erase the telltale marks of age and restore what time has taken away."
So before we get to the more reputable science, we need to explore the fringes. From treatments involving the sex organs of monkeys to the questionable human growth hormone industry. We'll also take a look at cryonics and mind uploads, speculative science that believers hope will bring some people back from the dead.
"Do you want to live forever?"
"The dream of generations, eternal beauty."
"And who wants to be young forever?"
"I do! Me!"
This is episode 2, Phony Fountains.
"My dermatologist was raving about pure retinol. It's amazing."
That's former Desperate Housewives star Eva Longoria in an ad for a L'Oreal product that's supposed to make your wrinkles, even big ones, go away.
"It's an anti-aging superstar.
New Revitalift Night Serum.
An anti-aging superstar? You've heard ads like these before, right?
I can tell you the secret to younger looking skin.
The global beauty industry is worth nearly $500 billion.
We'll smooth even the deepest wrinkles.
And it's grounded in the premise that beauty is about youth.
To reveal younger looking skin.
And this isn't a modern development. It's an ancient obsession. 2,500 years ago, Greek historian Herodotus wrote about a fountain in northern Africa that would make the skin of those who bathed in it glossy and sleek, and allowed them to live to 120 years old. Another tale has Alexander the Great discovering a spring that restored youth. And fountains weren't the only way to reverse aging.
One of my favorites is the origin of alchemy.
That's Jay Olshansky, who took the more moderate side in the billion-dollar aging bet. He wrote about these early myths in his book, The Quest for Immortality.
Remember, the whole purpose behind alchemy is to transmute lead into gold. But why was anyone interested in gold? Well, they weren't interested in gold because it had some sort of intrinsic value. They were interested in gold because the kings and the wealthy people of the time believed that ingesting minute quantities of gold would confer properties of immortality to them that the gold itself had. So the whole idea was to create gold cups that they could drink their wine from and thereby ingest minute quantities of this gold. And then, of course, modern chemistry arose as a result of alchemy. One of the others, which is an interesting one, is the suggestion that that older individuals can benefit by breathing the exhaled air of younger people. There have been lots of theories that go back thousands of years, and each one is more interesting than the next.
The most bizarre story I've come across is that of Russian-born Serge Veronov, who trained as a surgeon in France.
He was a serious student. He was a student of Alex Carrel, who was really instrumental for the first steps of transplantation.
Carol Haber is a historian at Tulane University in New Orleans. Her specialty is the social history of aging and death.
He was a very serious doctor, and in the period between 1919 and about the end of the 1920s, his work was taken very seriously.
Veronov traveled to Egypt, where he studied men who'd had their testicles removed. He observed that they seemed to age faster, and wondered if he might somehow reverse engineer this process to make old men young again. Veronov learned that decades earlier, a 72-year-old doctor had injected himself with a cocktail of testicles from guinea pigs and dogs. He'd boasted that the mixture had rejuvenated his sexual prowess. Thousands of Frenchmen signed up to get injections of this proto-Viagra. But Veronov thought that he could do better. Surely organs from primates would be more effective than guinea pigs. And why inject the organs if he could transplant them instead?
He took thin slices of testicles from chimps and baboons, and he attached them to patients' scrotums.
Yeah. And Veronov devised a similar procedure for women, extracting ovaries from chimps and implanting them into paying female patients. It's bananas, right? But people flocked to Veronov. The procedures became so popular in France that Veronov took them on the road, embarking on a worldwide publicity tour.
He brought around a patient with him, a man named Edward Leyday, who was 76 years old, and lots of pictures of him looking as if he was 45. He did die within 2 years, which wasn't a really good thing, but got a lot of public knowledge, particularly in the 1920s. There's a lot of before and after pictures, like we have today. And so you have some broken down old man, and then he's virile and filled with energy. And people reported that it did work. Of course, we know that it didn't work, but placebo is a really wonderful thing.
Veronoff wasn't the only doctor profiting off the supposed rejuvenating properties of testicles. A surgeon at San Quentin Prison would remove testicles from executed prisoners and implant them into other living inmates or sell them to rich outsiders. And several other doctors performed surgeries involving monkey glands. But Veronoff was the celebrity.
People thought this was a really wonderful thing, and he charged anywhere between 500 and 1,000 pounds per operation. And there are estimates that he probably, by the 1930s, had done 500 operations.
Veronoff even set up a monkey farm in the Italian Riviera to keep up with demand for monkey balls.
Throughout popular culture in the 1920s and the 1930s, there's a lot of discussion of monkey operations.
Very rich old ladies, even rich old gents, have squandered fortunes on monkey glands. And I don't know what
it's in the Marx Brothers movies. It's in songs. This was a very well-known thing.
If you're too old for dancing, get yourself a monkey gland and then let's go.
If you're too old for dancing, get yourself a monkey gland. Those lyrics were written by popular American composer Irving Berlin. Veronoff's work even inspired a cocktail. The monkey gland is made of gin, orange juice, grenadine, and just a dash of absinthe. The surgeon hoped the 1935 discovery of testosterone, secreted from testes and associated with male virility, might support his claims. Instead, Veronoff's flimsy pseudoscience began to fall apart. By the 1940s, the global medical community that recently held him in such high regard now openly mocked him. As a kid, I remember hearing a wild story about Walt Disney. You might have heard it too, that after he died of lung cancer in 1966, he'd had himself frozen in the hopes that future science might allow him to be brought back to life, cancer-free.
Ahoy, mateys! Be sure to stay seated with your hands, arms, feet, and legs inside the boat. And
weirder still, his body was supposedly stored in a tomb of liquid nitrogen, hidden underneath the Pirates of the Caribbean ride at Disneyland. The story isn't true. But when I visit Disney theme parks with my kids, I can't help feeling a little creeped out. Because even though Disney didn't do it, dozens have.
When your boat stops, please be stepping out to your right.
And thousands more are preparing to have themselves frozen with the hope that someday they'll come back, either through physical resurrection or by having their frozen minds uploaded into a robot or a virtual world.
Hi, I'm Linda Chamberlain. I'm one of the co-founders of ALCOR, Life Extension Foundation, where we offer the service of cryopreservation. Our default is we will bring you back as the biological entity that you were previously, with the one change that we probably won't bring you back old and disease-ridden, because what would be the sense of that? So the idea is you will come back, you will be free of disease, and you will be young.
50 years ago, Chamberlain came across a book about cryonics and became fascinated with the idea of it being a pathway to eternal life. She went to a meetup with other enthusiasts and met a NASA engineer who was as passionate about the idea as she was. They married and made cryopreservation their life's mission.
I have three family members cryopreserved at the moment. My husband, who's the other founder of ALCOR, his father and my mother. So it's very much a family affair.
So do you imagine seeing your husband and your mother again?
Yes, I do. That gives me a very happy, warm feeling to think about that. Two of my very favorite people in the world.
You want to get yourself cryopreserved? Here's how it's typically done. First, you need to decide if you want to preserve your entire body or just your head. Of course, the full body experience is more expensive. You pay annual membership dues each year you're alive, and you also need to take out an insurance policy that will cover your preservation and storage costs after you die. Then, within minutes of your death, your blood gets drained from your body and replaced with a kind of antifreeze that prevents the formation of ice crystals. Then you're shipped to a storage facility, maybe in Arizona, where you're preserved indefinitely at a temperature of 196 degrees Celsius below freezing. Now, if you're doing all this, you're making a bet on two separate technologies. First, that cryonics can preserve your brain without significant degradation. And second, that at some point in the future, you'll be brought back. Now, you'd think the main scientific challenge to cryonics would focus on the resurrection part, but that's not necessarily the case.
My name is Kenneth Hayworth. I'm president of the Brain Preservation Foundation. I'm also a neuroscience researcher at the Genelia Research Campus.
Hayworth grew up in a Roman Catholic family, but by the time he was 16, he was questioning the church's teaching. Having lost his faith in any kind of heavenly afterlife, he found faith in science. He earned a PhD in neuroscience and signed up for Alcor. Hayworth was confident scientists would figure out the coming back part, even if it took centuries. What worried him was the freezing part.
One of the articles that I read that gave me pause, one of many, was one by Michael Shermer, the great skeptic that he wrote in Scientific American, that, cryonics sounds like a good idea, but if you look into it, it's like if you put strawberries in the freezer, they're going to turn to mush. And I knew at that time that that was not true. That is a drastic oversimplification of the issues involved in cryonics. But it crystallized what the real argument was in the skeptic community against cryonics. Can we preserve the information content of a brain?
So Hayworth launched a contest, the Brain Preservation Prize.
You know, it was a challenge prize to the cryonics community, but also to the larger scientific community to say, look, the skeptics are saying we can't preserve a brain at the level that is preserving the synaptic connectivity. Let's get both communities together on a prize so that the skeptics have to look at the evidence when it is provided. So I was an Alcor member when that prize was put forward, and I expected that Alcor or some other cryonics organization would win it pretty darn fast. I actually expected them to win it. And so I was a bit flabbergasted that they couldn't prove to my neuroscience colleagues and to myself that this bare minimum had been reached.
Alcor hadn't been able to prove that its methods preserved enough of the electrical connections in your brain that make you you. Disappointed, Hayworth withdrew his membership in Alcor, giving up his reserved spot in a steel canister. Linda Chamberlain says Alcor's methods have improved and that if the contest were run today, Alcor would be able to claim the prize. Hayworth says he hasn't seen the evidence. But in the meantime, someone else won. Researchers at a company called 21st Century Medicine were able to preserve pig brains to Hayworth's standards. They did this by adding a preservation agent, a stronger version of formaldehyde, before the antifreeze. The pig brains were preserved perfectly, and Hayworth has no doubt that this procedure would work for human brains too. There are just two problems, and they're pretty big ones. First, in order to adequately preserve the brain, the process needed to begin when the pigs were still alive.
I guess the flaw in terms of seeing how this would apply to humans is that we're killing the animals when we do this.
And you're killing the humans if you were to do this as well. So this is a method of last resort. This is something that could provide another option for a terminal patient that has run out of all options. It's something that I would want to choose if I was in that position.
The ethical implications of what Hayworth is proposing are huge. But even if you set all that aside, there's another big problem. Even those who believe that a corpse or brain could someday be resurrected find it hard to believe that this could be done after the brain is fixed with a preserving agent. But to Hayworth, it doesn't matter. To him, it's not about bringing flesh back to life. It's about the information stored in the brain. He sees a future where the physical structure of the brain can be converted into a digital code. Every memory, every mannerism, every preference and emotion.
So what I believe, and it's just a belief, but what I believe is that the future of humanity is going to be in mind upload. There will probably be some biological humans that stick around, but for the most part, we will be mind uploads. That will have tremendous advantages that we can only dream of today. We will be able to make backup copies of ourselves, but we will also be able to shuttle back and forth between a robotic body on Mars to a robotic body on the Earth in just a few minutes. We will spend probably a majority of our time in virtual bodies, in virtual environments, just like we spend the majority of our time inside houses today. But we will occasionally use synthetic bodies, robotic bodies of the type that is suited for whatever we're doing in the real world.
If my mind were digitized and you were able to read the code, you'd see that I have a hard time believing that any of this is possible. The brain just feels far too complex to distill into code. And it raises all kinds of philosophical questions about what it means to be human, and ethical questions about a medical procedure that might allow you to live in the future, but will definitely kill you in the present. Personally, I don't want to live forever in the Matrix. But Hayworth, he's all in. He says it isn't going to be easy or cheap. It's probably going to cost hundreds of billions of dollars. But it's going to happen. Maybe as soon as the end of this century.
Do you think that this is something that you want to have done?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I volunteer to be the first.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart MacLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share 2 hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
Our journey through the fringes of aging has taken us to monkey ball farms, to cryonic storage facilities, and to virtual worlds.
Fasten your seatbelts. For the final stop on our tour, we join a flight already in progress.
It's the early 2000s, and scientist Tom Perls pulls the in-flight magazine from the seat pocket in front of him. As he mindlessly flips through the publication, he sees something that stops him in his tracks. It's an ad for hormone treatments that can supposedly slow aging. Perls is a gerontologist who's published important papers on aging in centenarians. But he's shocked at what he sees.
There they were talking about centenarians and said something about some findings that I had produced, but then somehow tried to connect their hormone replacement therapy that they were promoting to my work. And that was really quite distressing to me.
Pearl's research was part of the ad.
And then at one of the national academic meetings that I went to, one of these guys who was selling hormone therapy, particularly growth hormone, presented some findings that made absolutely no sense to me and sounded rather concocted. That's what really pushed me to learn more about what they were promoting.
Human growth hormone, or HGH, is a natural substance secreted by the pituitary gland. It's critical for growth in childhood and teenage years, and it continues to play a role in everything from metabolism to muscle growth throughout life. And there's evidence that the older you get, the lower your HGH levels. So it's not totally unreasonable to think that taking HGH supplements could reverse aging. Synthetic HGH was first developed in 1985, and that's what was now being sold as an anti-aging elixir. Pearl started looking into the claims of the HGH industry.
Anti-aging clinics were popping up in lots of places, selling not only growth hormone, you know, heavily marketing, and selling growth hormone and testosterone, DHEA, thyroid hormone, really coming up with what I call toxic hormone soups.
And the people taking these hormones, some of them developed serious side effects. Diabetes, swelling, blood clots.
And instead of stopping these drugs, these so-called doctors would start prescribing other medicines to fight the side effects of the drugs they were giving. And just really chasing their tails.
Three things became clear to Pearls. One, the claims that human growth hormone could reverse aging were unproven. Two, selling HGH for a condition that wasn't approved by the FDA didn't seem legal. And three, the supplements could have dangerous side effects.
And, you know, with the kind of marketing they were doing, they were getting plenty of people who were narcissistic and gullible and thinking that they could fight aging and stop and reverse it.
Pearls had another beef with the anti-aging industry. He was drawn to seniors as a kid, and in high school, he took a part-time job as an orderly in a nursing home. Now he was working with centenarians. He'd seen his patients do incredible things, like the 103-year-old woman who volunteered at a retirement residence and could still perform perfect piano concertos by Chopin.
The other thing that really disturbed me was the very false view of aging, where they really wanted to scare people about aging, you know, showing people in wheelchairs and in dementia units and bedbound and saying, this is aging and we can stop it. We can give you the cure. We can even reverse the clock and make you young again. And these were, you know, very false and I think very damaging. And I really got more and more interested in fighting what I really called quackery, anti-aging quackery.
Not long after, Pearls attended a conference with J.L. Shansky, who gave a presentation about his own concerns with HGH and the way it was being marketed and sold as an anti-aging drug. The two researchers decided to team up against what they saw as anti-aging charlatans. Olshansky had his own personal interest in hormone therapy.
My son was diagnosed with a malformed anterior pituitary gland when he was, it might have been 8 years old, 7 or 8 years old, and it was going to lead to stunted growth.
The medicine that could help him was synthetic HGH.
Then I gave my son a shot every day for, I think it was 4 or 5 years. That actually is what led me to dig in to the details of the potential dangers associated with growth hormone, but my focus was on children. But in the process of learning about the introduction of growth hormone into children, I learned about the potential dangers associated with using growth hormone in adults.
Pearls teamed up with Olshansky to publish an article in the influential Journal of the American Medical Association. They spelled out why prescribing HGH as anti-aging medicine was both reckless and illegal. But they didn't stop there. They took things in a more mischievous direction. Olshansky came up with the idea of giving out awards to the most outrageous longevity claims.
And I'm a professor of public health, so part of my job is to tell the truth about what we know about therapeutic interventions that can or cannot influence aging. And we decided to give out awards to those that were making rather extraordinary claims.
In 2002, Olshansky handed out the first Silver Fleece Award for anti-aging quackery. It went to Clustered Water, a U.S. company that charged $10 an ounce for water that had supposedly been enhanced to counteract the degenerative effects of getting old. A second award was handed out to an anti-aging not-for-profit that was training and accrediting doctors in the medical practice of reversing aging. Part of the group's training involved growth hormone. Not surprisingly, the winners weren't on hand when Olshansky presented the awards. Bottles of vegetable oil that had been relabeled as snake oil.
What it reminded me of was one of those tonic bottles from the 19th century. Remember those tonic bottles that were sold by hucksters?
The founders of the not-for-profit didn't take kindly to any of this. They initiated a $120 million lawsuit against Olshansky and Pearls.
And they said that's the amount of money that they thought they would have earned had they been able to sell their product. So naturally, our universities came to our rescue and they said, well, you guys are doing the right thing. So yeah, we'll go ahead and hire some lawyers. And they countersued.
The lawsuit went to what lawyers call discovery. This put the founders in the position of having to defend their anti-aging claims. Olshansky salivated over the opportunity.
There was no scientific evidence to support the claim. And as soon as that piece of information became evident to their lawyers and our lawyers, their lawyers came to our lawyers and said, we want this to go away. And my colleague Tom and I said, no, we actually want it to continue. We really want this to be exposed. And they said, well, the university's paying the bills. We're going to let it go away.
The two sides settled. And Olshansky kept giving out snake oil awards.
So yeah, we gave it out for several years. But eventually, we lost interest because the whole industry changed pretty dramatically.
By the mid-aughts, there just weren't as many phony rejuvenation products on the market anymore. But what about the claims made by the beauty industry?
It's an anti-aging superstar.
I have no problem with any of that stuff. I mean, they're not making any claims that it's going to make you live any longer. They're making claims that it's going to make you look younger.
With the junk science in retreat, Olshansky pivoted his focus. And in the process, he remade his brand. Until then, he'd been seen as chief skeptic. He'd used math to calculate the upper limits of human longevity. He'd taken the pessimistic side of the billion-dollar bet, and he'd drawn attention to the snake oil gumming up the good science. Then in 2006, he co-authored a paper calling for the U.S. government to inject $3 billion a year into understanding the biology of aging. He wrote, quote, "The belief that aging is an immutable process programmed by evolution is now known to be wrong." He argued that the science of aging had the potential to produce a longevity dividend that would provide social, economic, and health gains for generations to come.
We basically said, look, you know, in spite of all of this nonsense that's going on in the field of anti-aging medicine, there's a legitimate science that needs to be pursued aggressively. We need to do it very cautiously and carefully to make sure that nothing untoward makes its way to the public before it's tested for safety and efficacy. So our focus shifted from the nonsense to the science.
Next time on Unlocking the Fountain, we dig into the science around why we age.
The cause of aging must exist within cells.
Learn why lifespan isn't set in stone.
It's amazing.
It is. It's absolutely amazing. It's, you know, our biology is so plastic.
And meet an 11-year-old scientist at the center of it all.
There's kind of a special feeling that you have when there's a secret that you think most people should know, but they don't.
Unlocking the Fountain is hosted and written by me, Keith MacArthur. Our associate producers are Sarah Melton and Graham McDonald, who also does our sound design. Our digital producers are S.K. Robert and Emily Cannell. Chris Oak is our story editor. The voice of Hernando Descalante Fontaneda is Jordi Pradas. Additional audio from Prelinger Archives, Paramount Pictures, The Walt Disney Company, and ITV Anglia. Our senior producer is Tina Verma, and our executive producer is Arif Nourani.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.